On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democrats have called the maps passed by Republicans gerrymandering 2.0. The state Supreme Court ruled last week it would not consider partisanship as it draws new congressional and state legislative boundaries. And instead, the justices will attempt to make as few tweaks as possible to the 2011 maps. We found out what it means with one of the journalists behind the Mapped Out podcast. Have you followed redistricting? Did you submit your own map as part of the once-in-a-decade process? Do you feel properly represented in your district? 800-642-1234. Bridget Bowden is special projects reporter at WPR, co-host of the WPR podcast series Mapped Out, examining the history of legislative redistricting. Bridget, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So the state high court rules that it will take a least change approach to redrawing election maps. Break down what that actually means.
Sure. So redistricting happens every 10 years after the census. And basically, it's a way of readjusting our political lines, both for population and other changes that have happened in the state. So a least changes approach, what that means is that they would be adjusting for population and not much else. So they wouldn't be trying to drastically redraw the way the political lines are from the way they are right now.
And they've come under some scrutiny here, saying that, look, we're not going to look at partisanship here. Partisanship, as I understand it, isn't one of the guiding principles in drawing these boundary lines. Is that right?
It's not one of the principles that's required by the U.S. Constitution or the Wisconsin State Constitution. However, the issue is that the 2011 map, which is the previous map, the map that we're under currently, that we've been under for 10 years, has been highly criticized for heavily favoring Republicans. So there are many people who would like to see a less partisan map and would like for partisanship to be considered for the next map, but the justices have said that they won't be doing that.
So what about the federal three-judge panel? They had a trial date on map intervention. I think it was scheduled for late January, but the state Supreme Court has decided it's handling a redistricting lawsuit instead of federal courts. What is the status of the federal court here?
Right. So there's precedent that state courts do get kind of first dibs on redistricting cases. So that's why the state Supreme Court has gone first. There is still a chance that something could happen in federal court. I'm not sure exactly what would be the thing to happen, but that trial date that you mentioned is still on the books. So it is possible that something could happen there as well. And I should mention that there is a 4-day hearing set for the state Supreme Court, and that would be in January, but before the federal trial.
Okay, so before the federal trial. And, you know, just for the history here, which you've really dug into and mapped out, 82, 92, 2002 maps were created by federal judge panels. Why do you think the state Supreme Court has an appetite to take on maps this time around?
Right. There is a very long history of federal courts dealing with redistricting in Wisconsin. And Democrats this year, it was very clear that they really wanted the federal court to be the one to handle it. Democrats and a group of Democratic aligning groups both filed cases with the federal court. But the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which is a conservative law firm, they filed their case with the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So it was kind of one party wants one court, the other party wants the other court. And the state Supreme Court does get to take first crack at it. And so that's where we are right now.
And this is considered a big win for Republicans, I would imagine.
Yes, this first ruling absolutely is considered a big win for Republicans. A least changes map is something that Republicans have said that they want. The map that passed the legislature was touted as a least changes map by Republicans. And also, it makes sense that Republicans would prefer least changes map. The map that passed in 2011 has been very good to them over the past decade.
We're talking about the latest redistricting decision from the state Supreme Court with WPR's Bridget Bowden. She is co-host of the WPR podcast called Mapped Out, which looks at the history of legislative redistricting. You can join in. How do you feel about the latest decision from the Wisconsin Supreme Court? Have you been following the redistricting debate between Republicans and Democrats? What do you think? What have you been part of the process? 800-642-1234 to join in. Bridget, let's look at what the justices have been saying. Justice Rebecca Bradley wrote for the court's majority. What did she say about this ruling?
Right. Justice Bradley made it very clear that the court should not be making political decisions. And in this case, she believes that it would be a political decision to consider partisanship or anything like that. So that's what we have with the majority opinion, that the court should not be making any decisions that would affect politics.
But this also was a close decision. Can you kind of give us a sense of where the justices landed?
Right. So it was a 4-3 decision, meaning that it was split along the court's ideological lines. The three more liberal justices sort of took the opposite opinion as the majority, that and they said, you know, to take a least changes approach is an inherently political decision. So you have quite the opposite perspective there. Now, the justice who everyone was watching was Justice Brian Hagedorn, who is considered the court's swing vote. And he mostly joined the minority with just he mostly joined the majority with just a few points that he did not join. But he did side with the conservatives in this case.
What did Justice Hagedorn take issue to, or how did he deviate from the majority?
It was very, it was in the footnotes, and I actually would really like to talk to a lawyer or someone who could really explain what the finer points of what he didn't join were. But he, for the most part, with the exception of just a few key points, joined the majority. And he was the justice to watch, and so him joining the majority is significant.
Let's bring on a caller now. Nate is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Nate. Your thoughts?
Hi. Thank you for having me. I think the conservative majority has just signaled that they're in favor of using gerrymandering to rig elections. And I'll point out that when I read their decision, one of the things they said is that gerrymandering doesn't pick winners and losers of elections. Yet if people look at the emails of Republicans, including Lita Volkmer, which was disclosed because of its own court case, they actually named a Democrat that they want to get rid of, Stas Kunis from West Dallas, whose district was split up. And the majority's decision, therefore, can kind of be shown to be a lie or disproven. And all their claims of neutrality, no, they're starting from preserving something that is very biased. And this isn't just a loss for Democrats. This is a loss for anybody who wants politicians to be accountable.
Nate, thank you. Bridget, what do you hear there? Because the high court is supposed to be nonpartisan.
Right. That is correct. Although, you know, in the last few years, we have seen these candidates backed by political parties. There is an intense disagreement here in this decision. You see four justices saying that to take a least changes approach is not a political decision. And you see the other three saying it is a political decision.
We have WPR Special Projects reporter, Bridget Bowden with us on the redistricting ruling from the state high court last week, the once-a-decade process of redrawing our state's political boundaries. Do you have a question about where redistricting is at or what happens next in the process? What do you think of the state court ruling? Should the federal court step in? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute for more State Cap with Bridget Bowden here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about redistricting in Wisconsin on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When Governor Evers vetoed the Republican-drawn maps a little over 2 weeks ago, he released a video statement saying the legislature failed to deliver and the maps are gerrymandering 2.0.
Elected officials shouldn't be able to depend on the comfort of their seats instead of the quality of their work. And the gerrymandered maps Republicans passed a decade ago have enabled legislators to safely ignore the people who elected them.
Maps need to be in place by April 15th as candidates begin to pass out nomination papers for fall primaries. How do these maps look to you? 800-642-1234. We have WPR's Bridget Bowden, co-host of the Mapped Out podcast series, stays with us. Bridget, timeline here. People can submit map proposals to the state high court until December 15th. If the court has already telegraphed it isn't going to do much by way of the maps that it has, why does it want this input?
Right. So this is when we're going to see how the various parties interpret what least changes means. We have the legislature's map, which they have called least changes. However, if you really take a close look at the map, it does make some significant changes to the lines, especially in the Milwaukee suburbs area. So it's altogether possible that the court will not take up that exact map and will instead decide on something that makes fewer changes or different changes.
So it is still looking for public input.
Correct. Oh, it's map drawing is something that, of course, people of all sorts can do on various tools on computers. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they'll be taking input from interested parties in this case.
Courts aren't supposed to be map makers. Why do we have this system? Why isn't there a system where the lawmakers and the governor have to hash this out, have to negotiate it out and keep this out of the courts?
Sure. 10 years ago, that's exactly what happened. We had single party control of state government. So we had Republicans in both houses of the legislature and the governor's office. And that's exactly what happened. Maps were passed through the legislature and signed by the governor, and then they went into effect. However, the situation is quite different this year. We have split control. Our legislature is controlled by Republicans, and we have Democrat Governor Tony Evers in the governor's office. So the fact that they disagree was kind of a foregone conclusion. It was all but guaranteed that these maps were going to end up in court.
Let's go to another caller now. Janet joining us from North Fond du Lac. Janet, hi.
Hello. I am for dropping or getting rid of this gerrymandering altogether. Look where it's led to. I am so fed up, and so is my family, of the Republicans acting like spoiled brats. It's my way or the highway. It'll lead to nothing but eventually dictatorship. This started, I noticed it about 10 years ago when Governor Walker started pulling this and that.
Janet, what is your solution? What would you suggest?
Unbelievable.
Janet, what would you suggest? What is your solution?
Just get rid of it and have one vote for one person, like our forefathers meant it to be.
Janet, thank you. And Bridget, I want to just jump in here. You know, maps do create winners and losers. How do you drop a map that is fair? Is that idea that maps can be fair, is that far-fetched?
You know, it is very complicated, and different people have very different opinions about what is a fair map. And then also, you know, the principles that are required by the U.S. Constitution and the Wisconsin Constitution differ quite a bit from what many people believe is a fair map. I would say that this is among the most complicated topics I've ever reported on. Hmm. And, you know, there's a reason that there's so much disagreement. It is just extremely complicated.
Let's bring on Michael in Milwaukee with thoughts. Michael, hi. What's on your mind?
Well, first, a real quick statement is the fact that the justices did make a political statement with their decision because it was based on political lines. So, you know, no matter what they say, everybody knows what happened. But my question is, I've always wondered, you got these complicated maps. Of course, parties spend millions and millions of dollars deciding how are we going to get the most voters in our district here? Why can't we just have maps that are geometrically designed after counties? Let's say you divide the state into however many counties we have. Okay, each county is a district. If you need more districts, you split the county in half on road lines, straight this way, straight that way, or on a river. You don't just go one street over here and one street over there to try and collect voters, and everybody knows that's what's happening. But I think the map should be basically just geometric lines. If you want 50 districts, you got 50 counties, this county is in this district, and then you pick your representative in your county. Why can't it be that simple?
Michael, thank you. Bridget, what is your sense there on why you can't draw these from geometric lines?
Yeah, you know, caller mentioned county lines, and it's funny because way back in history, it actually did used to be like that. However, the principle of one vote, one person, one vote, which is now federal law, really makes just simply sticking to county lines really impossible. Because if you think about it, some counties have significantly more population than other counties, and you know their votes would not be as powerful if the lines were drawn simply along county lines. So it can't just be county lines because of one person, one vote, and then. You know, the caller mentioned, you know, maybe using road lines or municipal lines, town lines. In theory, that is the way that it should be. We have in the Wisconsin Constitution, it says that you really shouldn't be splitting up that many local boundaries, which is like, you know, municipal lines, town lines, that sort of thing. You should try your best to avoid. And you should also keep districts as compact as practicable. The trouble is that this is a puzzle with 99 pieces in the assembly, right? So it is just so complicated, and it you know, it's about power. And when you have so much power at stake, people are going to take advantage of it. And that's what we've seen in Wisconsin and in many states.
If you're just joining us, we have WPR's Bridget Bowden, special projects reporter who's been following the latest decision regarding redistricting, has looked into the history of redistricting in the Mapped Out podcast. You can join in 800-642-1234. Anne is with us in Campbellsport now. Hi, Anne. What would you like to say?
Hi. I just wanted to emphasize how detrimental this gerrymandering is to the individual voter. I have not seen an opposing candidate in my district for decades because the way the lines are drawn, anybody opposing knows they aren't going to win. My other point is I feel voiceless because I contact my legislators a lot on issues, Dewey Strobel, Dan Rantham. Never do they respond to me because they don't have to. And my third point is the majority of Wisconsinites want a bipartisan committee to draw the map, but our Republican legislators refuse to even bring it to the table. So it's affecting the majority of people. That's my comments.
And thank you, Bridget. And saying that she feels voiceless in this process and it's detrimental to the individual voter.
Yeah, that's something that I've heard from voters, including there was a woman we talked to for the Mapped Out podcast who ended up being a plaintiff in Wisconsin's famous redistricting case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court a few years ago. And she said exactly the same thing. She lives in northern Milwaukee, and she feels like she doesn't have a voice politically because of the maps.
Do you anticipate this will go back to the Supreme Court?
So the United States Supreme Court has said that partisan gerrymandering cases are not justiciable at the federal level. So I don't expect to see any sort of partisan gerrymandering case brought to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is what we saw last time.
Let's go to Joan in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak. We have waited for over 10 years for opportunity to correct these egregious gerrymandered district lines that were rammed down our throats in 2011. This is definitely the conservative members of our Wisconsin Supreme Court acting just like the GOP and protecting them, and they should be ashamed of themselves. And guess what, Justice Rebecca Bradley, you're not fooling any of us. We haven't had a fair election in Wisconsin since 2009, before these egregiously gerrymandered district lines were rammed down our throats. And thank you for allowing me to speak.
Joan, thanks. Bridget, you know, these maps are meant to last 10 years, but that is the point that they're supposed to be then go back to the drawing boards. Isn't that right?
So the Wisconsin State Constitution says that every 10 years, the legislature shall redistrict anew or district anew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, take that as you will, whether that means draw completely from scratch or start from a certain starting point.
Very quickly here, what was the most surprising thing you learned from reporting out the history of redistricting?
I would say that the most interesting thing or surprising thing was that the principles that we use to redistrict are complicated and often conflict with each other. So, you know, like I was explaining earlier, sometimes in order to meet the one person, one vote requirement, you have to make compromises in some of the other principles that you use. So you may make a district less compact or something like that. So it's complicated.
Bridget, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bridget Bowden is Special Projects Reporter for WPR, co-host of the WPR podcast series Mapped Out, which follows Wisconsin's history of redistricting. We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. News update is next on the Ideas Network. Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A big thank you to everyone who donated during the year-end member drive. Our entire community has access to trustworthy information and quality entertainment on Wisconsin Public Radio because of support from people like Jen in Greenville. If you missed the drive, there is still time to make a difference for the programs you value and families in need. Donate now. Ask for a food bank thank you gift. Your year-end gift ensures a strong finish to 2021 and a bright future for the news, the talk, the entertainment you and your neighbors rely on. Join in now with your donation at WPR.org. Now you have a line to Republican State Senator Mary Felskowski, who represents the northeastern corner of our state, including Antigo, Tomahawk, Rhinelander, and Eagle River. Here's some roadmap for our conversation. We'll discuss a bill to save paper mills in Wisconsin Rapids, Governor Evers' education funding, and we start with teenagers on the job. A bill that passed the Senate proposes rolling back some limitations on the hours that younger teens can work in the school year and summer. Should teens be allowed to work more and later into the night? Join in 800-642-1234. State Senator Mary Felskowski, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's great to be here.
So if I have this right, younger teens now can only work until 7 in the evening during school, but this bill would extend that to 9:30 at night during the school year. Can you give us some framework to what this bill effectively does?
So this was brought to me by a local small business owner. She actually owns a small, like a putt-putt golf in the city of Tomahawk. Mm-hmm. So a lot of young kids love working there. You know, they serve ice cream, they help with the mini golf, and it's a way for them to get their first job. But during the school year, like during those spring hours or even the fall hours where they're still open, they can only work till 7 o'clock. Well, then she has to bring in someone else to finish out that shift and close down because the golf course was open till like 8 or 8:30. So she said, this is silly. You know, if these kids are in school, they're still doing their sports. Catechism goes till 7, 8:30 at night. Why can't they work? You know, we allow them to be up and doing things, curfew, sporting events, and everything else. A lot of these kids that aren't involved in that want to be able to have a job. So what we did, and a lot of this is covered, these are only small businesses that employ less than 5 people because everything else is covered by federal law. We just extended those hours out to allow them to have that opportunity. This is not putting kids in slave shops and putting them, you know, working horrendous hours into the middle of the night. This is just extending those hours, no different than if they were involved in extracurricular activities.
So this applies to very, very small businesses. You said less than 5 employees?
Correct. Otherwise, everything other than above that is covered by federal law.
The bill, that's something that stuck out to me, said minors under 16 years of age who are employed after 10 p.m. must receive at least 8 consecutive hours of rest from the end of one shift to the beginning of the next shift. And that, you know, that caused me pause. I found that concerning that there is the potential for the allowing these young people to work a lot.
Well, but I mean, at some point, take a step back. This is parents. Okay, this is put into there, but I mean, parents still control the lives of their children. It's not like parents are having these kids work till 9:30 at night and then, you know, back at it at 6 a.m. in the morning. You know, think common sense wise. So let's say this mini golf, they probably don't open till noon. You know, or if they wash dishes in a restaurant, you know, a supper club around the state. You know, they might wash dishes until the supper club closes the kitchen at 9:30, but it doesn't mean they get up and go to work at 6 a.m. and the supper club's not even open. I mean, put common sense in there, not just what the bill says.
Do you have any idea how many businesses could be affected by this legislation?
Statewide, any business under 5, and I have no idea how many of those are.
The League of Women Voters of Wisconsin opposes the bill, and the head of the Wisconsin chapter of AFL-CIO Labor Union argues that the bill would continue the slippery slope of eliminating child labor protections. Do you feel like it goes that direction?
No, no. I think, you know what, that's the saddest thing to being an elected official. That's one of the saddest things that I've ever seen, is instead of taking a step back, a lot of these groups, they do extremisms. And take a step back and think about this. So look at the individual situations as they happen and what is actually out there. I mean, Representative Loudenbeck did a bill a couple years past, because if you were a child in foster care, you couldn't even get a job because you didn't have an adult that would sign your work permission slip. I mean, and they fought that too, where guardians couldn't, so you could even get like an after-school job. This is just common sense. So instead of bringing somebody in to close down from like 7 to 9 o'clock, pick up that shift, it allows those kids to work later. And don't forget, parents are in ultimate control. Parents are in control.
Some educators would say jobs distract from school, plain and simple. How do you see that delicate balance, especially for younger teens?
See, and I disagree with him 100%. I know all through high school, I had a job washing dishes at a local supper club. I think it added, it made me more responsible with my time, no different than extracurricular sports. You know, if I'm playing on the basketball team or the volleyball team, I have to delegate my time. I have to use my time wiser so that I can get my schoolwork done, as well as, you know, go to practice and go to the games. And a lot of times, living where I lived in northern Wisconsin, I didn't get home till 2 a.m. from the games. So you had to be more responsible with your time and use your time wisely. I think work does the same thing. Work teaches you a lot of valuable lessons that you can't get in the classroom, how to be responsible, how to, you know, interact with others. And it's an opportunity for your first job. So I disagree. And I'm going to just reiterate it one more time. Parents are in ultimate control of this. If their kids aren't doing well in school, then maybe it's time for work to stop. And parents are the best advocates for their children. So this is up to the parents.
We're talking with Mary Felskowski, who's a Republican state senator in Irma, represents the northeastern part of Wisconsin. You can join in. Should teens be allowed to work more? What should Wisconsin do to combat the state's labor shortage? Join in at 800-642-1234. How much is this tied to the current situation around labor and so many businesses not able to find employees?
Well, the bill is not tied to that at all. Absolutely zero correlation. This was for opportunity for the kids that wanted to work to allow them to work. But having said that, with the shortage of labor out there and with the number of people that have not returned to the workforce, I think it will help. It'll help fill in little gaps where, again, you know, I've got school ends at 3:30. So if my 15-year-old starts at 5 o'clock, he can only work till 7. I don't have to bring somebody in. If I close down at 8 or 8:30, they can work that entire shift. So it makes it more convenient for the employer and gives more opportunity to the kids that want to work.
But do you think teens will take jobs that are lower wage and take on more frontline worker risk? I'm thinking of these mom and pop businesses that may no longer be attracting the adult workers who are willing to work without health care benefits, willing to work for low wages, and not willing to take the risk of being a frontline worker.
Well, I think part of it is when you have no job experience, you know, and most teens do not, so they're going to come in and take entry-level positions. That's just reality. When you enter the workforce and you don't have the experience, whether it's trained in maybe doing the dishes or cooking or whatever, you're going to be an entry-level worker. That's just how the world works. So they would probably come in as an entry-level worker until they pick something, you know, picked up some of the skills, which they do very, very quickly.
Let's bring on Dennis in Madison. Hi, Dennis. What are your thoughts?
Well, I respectfully, the elected official is trying to make it sound like a building experience for the youngsters. But to me, it just seems like another ploy to get some cheap labor for the business lobby. And you can slice it and you can dice it any way you want, but I'm not buying what the elected official is, and I assume it's a Republican, is trying to sell.
So, and Dennis saying here, this goes back to able to offer lower wages to these younger teens, State Senator Felskowski.
I think, you know, I'm just going to look at the businesses that I'm talking about here. We have a local ice cream shop where the kids scoop ice cream, okay, and they sell ice cream, Windmill Ice Cream Store. It's an opportunity for the local kids to be able to work at that. The putt-putt mini golf. When I was that age, I went to my neighborhood supper club, and I got to do dishes there. I got to earn my own pocket money, was very proud of that. And it taught me, you know, the responsibility and the respect of work. So, I mean, you can try to spin it however you want. We are not talking thousands of people entering the workforce over this. We are talking about young kids that want to work. A lot of them aren't involved in extracurricular activities at school because we know that's a limited number of kids that can participate. This gives them opportunities after school or, you know, in the spring, during the summer. That's all it is. You can try to make it as nefarious as you want.
Let's go to Lenora in La Crosse. Hi, Lenora, and you are a mother of a teenage son. Is that right?
That is correct. So given current demands, we can't count on managers to limit the number of hours that these kids are requested to work or to count on them to give the evenings off that are needed for extracurricular activities. With my teenager, he was pushed to work as late as the store was open or was legally allowed. We can't count on these kids only working at putt-putt golf or an ice cream shop, which I did myself and learned a great work ethic. When these businesses are open early in the morning and late at night, don't have enough employees to keep their stores open as many hours as are needed, they're going to push these kids. And to say that it's the parents' responsibility, you're really demonizing the parents when the kids aren't making rational decisions on their own. If it's common sense that kids aren't going to be pushed to work 8 hours, you know, of rest only, that businesses are going to respect that, then why can't it be common sense that we write into the legislation that they have to be given 12 hours of rest?
State Senator Lenora, thank you. State Senator, go ahead.
So once again, I'm going to differ with you. I think it is the parents' responsibility to monitor what's happening in their teen's life. And if the work situation isn't working out for your child, you know, if what they're doing isn't working with their schedule, their schoolwork, then it's up to mom and dad to say, you know what, no, I don't think that you can be working at this time. And maybe, you know, that they negotiate with whoever the employer is. So I just don't think that that's government role. That's mom and dad's role to see if this is working for your child, then that's great. Let them continue to do that. But if it's not working for your child and your child is becoming exhausted, they're not getting the rest they need, and they're not keeping up in school, then it's time for mom and dad to say, you know what, put the brakes on this. You know, your schoolwork comes first.
Don't you think, though, that employers will push to get the maximum amount of time they can from their employees when they are in a staffing crunch like this?
I think employers are going to try that. But once again, mom and dad, parents, are in control of this. And we are talking extending these hours very limited. So these are for young juveniles, not even of driving age yet, barely of driving age. And it's giving them an extra hour to an hour and a half during the school year. This isn't giving them 12 hours in a sweatshop and then picking up the next morning.
One more call.
I just want to reiterate. I mean, my kids worked, but if I saw that it was interfering in their schoolwork or whatever, we put the brakes on it. Mom and dad are in control here, not the employers.
Let's go to Marty in Lake Geneva. Marty, hi.
Hi, good morning. My question would be, is if mom and dad are in control, then why do we need this legislation?
Right now it's prohibited. We are expanding the hours and giving more control to mom and dad.
We have Republican State Senator Mary Felskowski, who assumed her Senate seat this year. Prior, she served in the Assembly beginning in 2012. We're going to move on from this topic. How do you feel about legislation to rescue two shuttered paper mills? What do you want lawmakers to understand about your economic situation in these times? What message do you have for the state senator on education funding in our state? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have State Senator Mary Felskowski with us as we talk about legislation moving through the Capitol. She has a seat on the 16-member Budget Writing Committee Joint Finance. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Should schools receive federal pandemic aid based on how much of the pandemic they held in-person classes? Should lawmakers try to save shuttered paper mills and prop up the industry through legislation? Join in, State Senator Mary Felskowski with us for about seven more minutes. Let's talk about paper mills in Wisconsin. Been struggling, the one in Park Falls being auctioned off for parts last month. You introduced a bill to offer the Verso Mill in Rapids a $1 million loan in order to pay its heating bills. Is, you know, what do you see out of this legislation?
You know, Joy, this is a huge topic, and this is something you and I could talk about for 30 minutes. Actually, when the park, both paper mills, when they went down, were profitable. Verso Paper Mill in Wisconsin Rapids did not shut down because it was not making a profit. This is an international company that is manipulating the markets. And one of the things that this is not about a paper mill, and this is not about the $900 jobs at the paper mill, 900 jobs. This is about the forest products industry and what do we do with the wood that we need to sustainably harvest in the state of Wisconsin. Because the Verso Paper Mill itself, through their pulp mill, took 25% of the wood that's harvested in the state of Wisconsin. Now, there's different levels of wood, and they took pulp. And the pulp is more of your lower quality. It's not saw log quality. It's not going to be used in any of the hardwoods, so you're not going to see it in home building and things of that nature. So not only is the Verso Mill important to the 900 jobs that are in and around the Wisconsin Rapids area, they had 800 contracts for ancillary services from contractors all over the state of Wisconsin and the Midwest.
But
then you take the millions of cords of woods that they took. So now you're looking at wood that needs to be harvested. It's your loggers. It's your convenience stores. It's your repair shops. So it's a very huge topic for our economy in the state.
I'm hearing you say there is this huge ripple effect in so many other businesses linked into the industry. But should lawmakers be propping up the paper mill industry? Is this effective policy? Is this effective precedent?
So we've done it before with a lot of different industries. We did it with Mercury Marine. We've given millions to Marinette Marine. If we do not do this, what is the trickle-down effect? If we can't harvest, so you have all these millions or hundreds of thousands of MFL owners that own land in the state of Wisconsin that by law have to cut the wood on their land and put it to market. We are already hearing for people that can't get their wood cut because there's no market. Then you have all the county forests. You have the county forests that have purchased land. They manage their county forests. They manage it for aesthetics. They manage it for wood harvest. They manage it for sustainable, like grouse hunting and deer hunting, so that we have, you know, wildlife management habitats. They're having a hard time cutting that wood because we don't have markets. In addition to that, trickle down even farther, when you have an over and abundance, because we have a higher mortality of our trees in the state of Wisconsin than we do what we were harvesting, now you have the issue with fire. So this is a huge issue to the state of Wisconsin. And we have seen this happen in other states where they've, you know, reined in their paper mill industries and they haven't had the harvest, California being one of them, Indiana number two. So this is not just about propping up one paper mill. This is about what do we do with the abundance of wood and tree mortality in a state like Wisconsin.
What about the timing here? If, you know, if your chamber doesn't meet until next month, and this is about the cold, you know, trying to keep the heat on, lights on.
Well, Verso Mill, I mean, the bill that was put out there was basically put out for the Park Falls Mills because we had the investors for the Park Falls Mill. Because Park Falls is unique. Not only does it make a paper product, and the people that were looking to buy that were going to change it to more of a packaging corrugated medium, but they also produce what's called a liquor. And that residue liquid is used in other industries, and they felt that they could get this up and running and make it extremely profitable. They could not come to terms with the salvage. So Park Falls is now going to go to salvage, which is very sad because it will never permit another paper mill like that. Verso, I don't know why the assembly, they're the first one to put out the bill. They put the $1 million they're in for Verso. Verso has their packaging plant still going in Wisconsin Rapids where they cut and box the paper. They're just not, they're not actually running the mills. Those mills were profitable when they shut them down. One of the things that Verso did as an international company, by shutting down the Rapids paper mill, it now drives down wood prices. So right now, what the loggers are being paid and what the other mills are being forced to pay out is almost like 1990 rates. So the other mills are making a much higher profit. So this is kind of market manipulation by very large corporations also. Free market, I understand that. But if we can get the Verso mill up and running, it will do a lot for the economies in rural Wisconsin. Because if you talk to the loggers from the southwestern part of the state, they used to haul to the Rapids paper mill. And they have a lot of that lower quality pulpwood. They're now hauling all the way to Tomahawk and up to Hayward, which is just killing the profitability on that. And we're going to see markets dry up.
We have Mary Felskowski, Republican state senator in Irma, represents the northeastern corner of our state as we talk about the pulp and paper industry. Let's take a call now. Louis in Oconto is with us. Louis, hi.
Yes. Instead of giving grants, maybe we should have some rules on some of how these manufacturers operate in the state. And if they're going to operate in the state, maybe they should have to either, if they're not going to operate the business, either sell it to their employees, which actually they want it to do, the employees want to buy it, or have some recourse that they'll have to give extra tax dollars to it. It kind of seems to me that it looks like the Republican Party favors business so much until they get stabbed in the back.
Louis, thank you. Short on time here. State Senator Felskowski.
That's a whole nother if we want to talk tax policy and different things. That's always open and on the table. But businesses do own their own business. And, you know, they have the right to make those decisions based on what's good for their shareholders also. So that's a very tough situation to get in. I know right now there is negotiations going on where there are companies trying to buy out.
Thank you for joining us.